Right now, it's time for a monthly check-in with Discover Magazine for the latest science news. The further north you travel, the more the landscape changes visually and beneath your feet. As you get closer to the Arctic Circle, the ground becomes permafrost. As the temperature rises globally, this frozen land is starting to thaw, and that could have unintended consequences. Then throw out everything you ever thought you knew about being right or left-handed, and we learn about some exciting news about one of our evolutionary cousins. Gemma Tarlak is the senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello and happy science to you, my friend.
To you too. And there's some happy science news today. Big news out just a little while ago today. These guys, Homo naledi, already one of the most interesting sort of evolutionary stories out there of the last few years. Give us some background on these guys before we talk about this new news.
Well, you know, the amazing thing about Homo naledi, there's a lot that's amazing about this particular hominin. And basically, the more we find out, the more intriguing it becomes. Back in 2013, paleoanthropologists in South Africa discovered this site almost completely inaccessible, deep in a cave system. And they found the human fossil record, tons of fragmentary finds, maybe one mostly complete individual. But at this site, they found at least 15 individuals present. And since then, they found an additional Homo naledi site. So they have all these members of Homo naledi all found together. And the actual anatomy of this hominin is really fascinating because it's a blend of very early characteristics and much later characteristics. And one of the things that really intrigued people was the size of its brain. Its brain seems very small for its body. So in addition to all the other things, all the other questions swirling around Homo naledi, the question was, well, how does it work? How does it get around? What did it do? What was it capable of with a brain that's less than half as big as the modern human brain?
And it looked like in this cave, and that's a whole story that we've talked about on the show before, how these Homo naledi were found and how they needed tiny, skinny people to crawl into these caves and actually get them out. And John Hawks, a UW researcher, connected with this. Anyway.
Absolutely.
But the idea is, okay, these guys, they could have had a really small brain, but they were doing something really on purpose. It looked like they were placing their dead in this obscure place in certain ways, but that didn't seem to add up with the brain size. So that takes us to this new news today. What are we seeing?
Yeah, that's right. And just to recap a little bit, their small brain volume made a lot of people think that they were just not cognitively capable of processing the idea of intentionally placing your dead. And I have to say, there's still a lot of controversy over whether they actually did that. That's just one theory, and there's a lot of critics of it. But one of the things the critics kept saying was, oh, they have a tiny brain, they couldn't have done it. But what today's research reveals is that their brains, yes, they were definitely smaller, they were less than half the size of modern human brains, but structurally, their brains had a lot of what we think of as advances in later members of the genus Homo, including ourselves.
How do they know that? Because, right, there aren't brains left over in here. It's all bones. It's all the hard stuff. So how do they figure out how complicated a brain was?
Exactly. They're able to take what are called endocasts, and basically it's an impression of the inside of the skull.
Wow.
And, you know, in life, there are a few layers of tissue between the actual brain and the actual skull, so it's not an exact imprint. However, they have enough of these endocasts from other fossil hominins, from members of living species, including other primates. They've got enough of them to have a really good idea of what an endocast can tell us about the actual brain itself. So when they made these endocasts of several Homo naledi specimens, they discovered that there are certain structures in the brain that you don't see in other primates like apes and chimps. And you also don't see them in Australopiths. And they are the earlier hominins, the earlier members of our family, like Lucy. Everybody knows Lucy. She was an Australopith. But Homo naledi, a lot of people expected that because the Homo naledi brain is about as big as an Australopith's, maybe a little bit larger, everyone expected to find a similar structure to those earlier, more primitive species. However, their structure, again, much more advanced. It's got several particular features that have really long names that I'm not going to say on air because they'll take forever and I'll say them wrong. But anyway, they could tell structurally that it has a lot of the features that later members of the genus Homo, including you and me and everybody listening, We have them, and they are specifically features that control things like planning and communication and tool making. So now they're thinking, because their brains were smaller but more advanced, maybe Homo naledi was capable of all these more advanced cognitive tasks that people just kind of wrote off in the beginning.
And one question, this is cool, this tells us more, kind of tantalizing too. Are we starting to figure out where they fit in on our family tree, if I can be Homo sapiens-centric here, how they're related to us?
Yeah, and you know, one of the really interesting things that has come out since 2015, when Homo naledi was first described in the scientific literature, at that time, in 2015, they could not definitively say how old the species was. So a lot of people thought, oh, it's really old. It's one of those bridges between Australopiths and the genus Homo. Really old, whatever. But then in 2017, they found out that these specimens are only a couple hundred thousand years old. So what that means is it looks more and more like Homo naledi was kind of this offshoot on the family tree, where they existed much more recently than we would have thought. Another example of that is Homo floresiensis, better known as the Hobbit in Indonesia. And that's another example of it. It seems like these, what we see at face value, these perhaps more primitive hominins, they were around at the same time we were. And they just evolved in this different direction for whatever reason. It obviously gave them some kind of evolutionary advantage in their environment. So it's again, this interesting kind of modern relic issue in our family tree. No one is sure how closely they are related to us in particular. That is still up for debate, but there's so much happening in the field and so many new connections found that I think in a few years we're going to find out more about how closely related we are to them.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, checking out some of the coolest stories in the world of science. Some stuff that is cool, but not as cool as it should be. Gemma, permafrost, it's supposed to be frozen year-round, year after year, more and more. It is thawing, and this is bad news, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm not laughing. I'm laughing at your pun.
At the pun. Oh, yes. Yeah.
At
my ill-timed jape, yes.
But yes, this is very bad news, and it's very bad news for a lot of different reasons. Some reasons people may not think of. Everyone, I think, kind of knows there's a ton of carbon stored in the permafrost. So as it continues to thaw, researchers across the board expect the carbon to be released, no longer to be stored in the permafrost, but released into the atmosphere, which is, you know, we don't need that to happen, let's just say that. And I think it's important to remember what permafrost is. It's,
yeah,
it's really basically defined as ground, and that could mean rock, it could mean soil, it's some ice. It's a lot of organic material, animals and plants that have died, but also tons of archaeological artifacts, things like pieces of clothing that are thousands of years old, they're actually finding preserved in the permafrost. So it's all this organic stuff in addition to the rock and the soil and the ice. And the definition of it stays frozen for at least two consecutive years. But in many parts of the Northern Hemisphere, the permafrost has been frozen for hundreds of thousands of years. So now that it's thawing, that's where all the problems are arising in a lot of different ways.
And one of those, some people are, you know, have built cities on permafrost, and now that could sink in. And also, this surprised me, permafrost is a great place for viruses to survive, and they think outbreaks of things like anthrax in animals may be thousands of years old viruses.
Yes, yes. In fact, a couple of years ago, researchers isolated two viruses from 30,000-year-old permafrost deposits, and they woke those viruses up in the lab very easily. And so it is true that there is a lot, you know, there are victims of smallpox and plague and the 1918 influenza pandemic. There are, again, victims of anthrax, and they're all in kind of the upper levels of the permafrost, the active layers, and it is very possible. In fact, just a couple years ago in Siberia, there was an anthrax outbreak that they think was the result of thawing anthrax victims. that reinfected living people. But the real danger, if any of these diseases were to pop up, it's bad. But we kind of know what to look for, and they're hoping that quarantine, modern treatments, they could contain it. The researchers' real fear is that with mining operations and other industrial operations going deeper and deeper into this permafrost, they're worried that they're going to find and reactivate, say, a 600,000-year-old virus that we have never seen before and that we have no weapons to fight. That's their big fear. And it's scary stuff, I'll admit. It's you know, not a fun thing to talk about, but it heartens me somewhat that there are researchers looking at this very seriously and trying to figure out what to do about it before it happens.
All right. Well, on a less scary note, Gemma, you wrote about why you're left-handed and why I'm right-handed, and it may not be the reasons we used to think. Why?
There's nothing scary about that. Left-handed right. people are just better than everyone else.
Right. And you used to fence, you wrote, and I fenced briefly, and wow, it was hard fencing against left-handers.
Yes. You know, it's great. As a fencer, all I had to do was stand there because it's, you know, right-handed. People have a huge disadvantage in fencing. But in any case, yeah, you know, for years and years as a southpaw, I was told, oh, you know, the right side of your brain controls the left side of the body, so only left-handers are in their right minds. Haha. Well, that's not true at all. you know, I was taught by nuns who often reminded me that being left-handed was a sign of the devil. Also not true, thank you very much. And they're finding out, for example, you know, left-handedness, it doesn't even start in the brain. It appears that it starts in the spine. And when the embryo is only about 8 weeks old, they're already showing a clear preference for left over right. And paleoanthropologists are doing studies, really fascinating studies, looking at scrape marks on teeth. And they think they can figure out who was left-handed way, way back in our family tree. Neanderthals, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, maybe even Homo naledi one day. I don't know that they've done that particular analysis on Homo naledi, but we're finding that left-handedness just turns out to be natural variation, and it doesn't necessarily mean anything. And in fact, it doesn't even mean you're going to be super smart or smarter than the average right-hander. So it's just, you know, kind of like blonde hair versus brown hair. It's just a thing, and all you right-handed people have to get used to it because we're not going anywhere.
Very briefly, Gemma, I think the weirdest fact that I've learned from you in all this time was in this piece. You know, we tend to be right-handed. A lot of animals, they don't show a preference, or you just can't tell. Kangaroos tend to be left-handed?
Yeah, certain species of kangaroo are definitely left-handed.
How do we know? Like, what are they doing? They're throwing their softball left-handed? I don't know.
That's the paw that they punch you with when you bother
okay.
them.
Well, I shan't be doing that then. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She joins us around this time every month to share some of the coolest stories from the world of science.